How do we count and account for the costs of the government's war on terror? We'll talk to James Risen, author of Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War.
It seemed to me that what the war on terror had become in 13 years was a search for cash and a search for power and status.
What is the British fascination with murder? Lucy Worsley will explain all, joining us to talk about her new book, The Art of the English Murder.
They started to consume murder in a way that you can still see the modern media doing it today. Just look at the Pistorius trials.
Alexander Alter will be here with notes from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. James Risen joins me now. His new book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Hi, James.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, this is a book that covers a lot of territory. Tell us briefly about what it was you set out to write about in the book.
What I wanted to do is I'd written one book before about the war on terror, and I wanted to follow up with a new book that kind of looked at where we were 13 years after 9/11 and how we had what started out in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 is kind of a search for justice or a search for retribution or whatever you want to think, say we were doing right after 9/11 as a country. It seemed to me that what the war on terror had become in 13 years was a search for cash and a search for power and status, and that it was becoming an endless war in which we had a new mercenary class of people who were taking advantage of the war on terror, and that enormous unintended consequences had happened. And I began to hear about just some really crazy things that were going on. And so I thought it would make a good story.
Was there one sort of especially Orwellian example that sort of said, okay, I have to write this book?
One of them was about the chapter I have called Rosetta. It's a very crazy story in which, and it's not entirely clear exactly what happened, even after I spent a lot of time investigating it. But it basically was a law firm in Charleston, South Carolina, represented the families of the 9/11 victims in a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia. The lead lawyer in that case was Ron Motley, who was famous for having defeated the tobacco industry in the 1990s in the big tobacco settlement, in which the tobacco industry, settled by giving hundreds of billions of dollars to the states. And Motley had become rich from that, and he was looking for something new to do. And after 9/11, he formed a class action lawsuit against Saudi Arabia representing the 9/11 victims. And in order to prove his case that Saudi Arabia was behind 9/11, he hired a series of investigators, and he wanted to create his own little kind of private intelligence apparatus to investigate. And one of the people he hired turned out also wanted to do intelligence operations for the U.S. government at the same time. And so the relationship eventually that developed, the very intertwined and weird relationship between the investigators for the lawsuit and their work for the Pentagon and the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration in the war on terror became so complicated and so difficult to tell what was really going on. To me, it was like a case study in how the war on terror had been turned for other uses and become something that you could never tell what was the truth and what was not the truth. And that, to me, was at the heart of the problems with the war on terror, that you can never tell what's real and what's concoction in the war on terror today.
A lot of the book is based on reporting that you did, that it just seems incredibly challenging, investigative reporter, even for a seasoned investigative reporter like you. There's so many people who don't want to go on the record. There's so much that I would imagine is hard to uncover. What was the reporting like for you?
Well, it took many years, and it was some of these stories like the Rosetta story, are so hard to figure out because nobody, very few people want to talk.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of requires, what I've learned is that books require a different level of reporting than newspapers, in the sense that you have to kind of develop relationships and sources that are deeper and more, you get a chance to do much more in-depth interviewing, but it is challenging. And one of the things that I found was that you have to be patient and let some of these stories unfold, because some of these stories were never the kind of thing that you would make sense in a daily newspaper, in the sense that you could only understand them with a lot of context and a lot of kind of following long threads of stories, if that makes sense.
Did a lot of it rise out of stories that the reporting that you had originally done for The Times?
Some of it. I mean, there was, for instance, I did a chapter called The Emperor of the War on Terror about Dennis Montgomery, who was a strange character who had done a story about him for the New York Times, along with Eric Lischblau, my colleague there at the Times. He's one of the most fascinating characters in the War on Terror. He was a computer software expert who convinced the CIA that he could decipher secret codes from Al-Qaeda in the Al Jazeera news broadcasts, and that he could tell the CIA numbers and letters that corresponded with flights that Al-Qaeda wanted to attack. And the CIA took this so seriously that the Bush administration grounded a bunch of international flights in Christmas 2003 based on what this guy was telling them. And when they realized it was a hoax, they covered the whole thing up and never did anything about it. So I had done a story for the Times about that, and then expanded on that and got a lot more information for the book.
How did you find out about him?
Well, he had been written about a little bit before we wrote about it, but I had also, even before he was written about by other people, I had heard from people in the CIA that there was this crazy operation that nobody wanted to talk about, that they were all embarrassed by. To me, that it's like a case study in just how crazy the war on terror has become. And the only thing that makes sense about why it's gotten so crazy is, I think, we kind of deregulated national security, and we took Cheney said we're going to take the gloves off. And that means we deregulated national security. At the same time, we poured hundreds of billions of dollars into counterterrorism. And so you've had enormous unintended consequences from what essentially is a national security crisis that is kind of like the banking crisis.
How did that deregulation occur? I mean, was it incremental? Was there one thing that the Bush-Cheney administration did?
Well, remember, Cheney said the gloves come off. And what that meant really was all of the reforms on national security that had been put in place in the post-Watergate era in the 1970s, after, the Church Committee and a number of people had begun to raise questions about the role of the CIA and the NSA and other agencies. Most of those regulations were either removed by the Bush administration or ignored. For instance, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which had been passed after Watergate to limit the ability of the NSA to spy on Americans, was ignored by the Bush administration. The rules on assassinations and all the various aspects of presidential executive orders dating back to the Reagan administration on the limits of intelligence operations were either ignored or bended or, winked at in various ways. And so now that sent a very strong signal into the intelligence community and into the military that if you have an idea for counterterrorism, go for it. Do it. Don't worry about the rules. And at the same time, Congress was pouring hundreds of billions of dollars and saying, okay, here's some money. Go spend it on counterterrorism. Do whatever you think is needed. The FBI, the Pentagon, everybody was had more money than they knew what to do with and no rules on what to do with it.
So the whole sort of wanted dead or alive, you know, whatever right. means necessary translated into a lot of money.
Everybody realized, all these hustlers and con men all over America realized, hey, I could go call myself a counterterrorism expert and I'll go make a lot of money.
Let's talk a little bit about the money. There's just some startling figures in here. I don't know if there's a particular statistic that leaps out at you as especially egregious.
The bottom line number is the best bottom line number I've found is that the wars on terrorism and in Iraq and Afghanistan, and if you roll everything up, everything we've done since 9/11 has cost us about $4 trillion.
And how much of that remains unaccounted for?
A lot. Nobody wants to look, you know. I've got a chapter about one particular operation, which is crazy, where the U.S. actually airlifted cash to Iraq early on in the war. And never kept track of it. And billions of dollars in cash.
This is the $20 billion and 11.7
yeah,
of it.
It was Iraqi government money that was held in bank accounts in the United States. The Coalition Provisional Authority and the Bush administration both airlifted it to Iraq, supposedly to help, you know, get the new Iraqi government up on its feet and to provide a cash infusion to the economy. You know, the money got to Baghdad, but then nobody could tell where it went once it got to Baghdad. What I found was that the Special Inspector General for Iraq, Stuart Bowen, became obsessed with tracking all this money down, and he found out that almost $2 billion of it was hidden in a bunker in Lebanon, where it had been stolen from Iraq, and you know, and people who had stolen it were hiding it there.
The financial costs associated with the war on terror are obviously stunning, and the numbers that you have in here are just bewildering. But you don't just talk about the financial costs of war. You talk about other costs. You have a chapter, the war on decency, the war on normalcy, the war on truth. What were the other sort of non-quantifiable costs?
Well, I think one of the things, the War on Decency chapter describes a number of things related to torture and the interrogation programs that we set up after 9/11. And I profile an army interrogator named Damien Corsetti, who has really been suffering post-traumatic syndrome from having conducted harsh interrogations. And he told me that virtually everyone from his unit that he knows, many of them also suffer from PTSD and in silence. And nobody in the government wants to acknowledge that the people we actually had physically do the torture, the harsh interrogations, are suffering from PTSD. They're not the lawyers or the psychologists or the politicians who were behind, you know, who talk about what they did and defend these programs. These are the actual people who had to go down into these cells and do it. They are suffering in silence. And he also described in great detail what he did as an interrogator and what he saw as an interrogator, which is pretty mind-blowing. He says that, well, he was in Afghanistan at Bagram Collection Point, which was a prison early on in the war on terror. In order to get through his interrogation, sometimes he would smoke dope with detainees. Both of them would get high, and then he would conduct an interrogation. Then he was transferred to Abu Ghraib. You know, after the Abu Ghraib scandal was broke in the public, he was charged by the military and tried for abuses, you know, allegedly committed at Bagram in Afghanistan, and then was acquitted because the army jury, believed the army was scapegoating him and other enlisted personnel while not holding any senior officers accountable. And in that chapter, I also describe the role of psychologists in the war on terror, and I have a number of emails that I obtained from a behavioral science researcher named Scott Gerwehr, who died several years ago. And I got his his computer email, you know, all of his emails, and they show a series of very close connections between the behavioral science and psychological professions and the intelligence community and the military on the interrogation issue.
Damien Corsetti was given full disability after he was acquitted. But
right.
Where is he now?
He's living in Savannah, Georgia, very quiet life. He's trying to deal with his PTSD. When I saw him, he had to smoke marijuana all the time in order to calm down. He had been featured early on after he got back from Iraq in the movie Taxi to the Dark Side. And in that movie, he had ballooned in weight right after he got home because of the drugs he was taking and the stress and from the trial and everything. And now he's slimmed down and looks better, but he's still suffering from PTSD.
I imagine there are people like him who are happy to have their stories told in this book, but also many people who are not happy to have a lot of this reporting out in the open. What's the reaction been like so far? The book's been out for a couple of weeks now.
Well, I've been very happy generally with the reaction. The readers seem to like it a lot. You know, a few people have complained, like the American Psychological Association doesn't like some of the things I said about the role of psychologists in the interrogation program.
But, providing, you know, sort of cover for their justifying torture?
Yeah, that there's a role of the APA and psychologists in the interrogation program. But, mm-hmm. you know, the emails that I have speak for themselves, and they haven't really raised any substantive criticisms. I think overall I'm very happy with the response I've gotten.
Well, an unhappy topic, but very important one. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The book again is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War by James Risen. Alexandra Alter is here now to tell us about what's going on in the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What is going on?
So there's a book that Simon & Schuster released this week that really caught my eye because it taps into a few of these trends that are really shaking up the publishing industry right now. One is fan fiction, which is something that's been thriving online for decades, but publishers are just starting to pay attention because of hits like 50 Shades of Grey, which started off as free Twilight fan fiction.
So for those non-fans out there, what do we mean when we say fan fiction?
That's a great question. It's a very broad sort of term, but we usually think of something like readers writing stories featuring Harry Potter, where they imagine that he's a friend of theirs, or, you know, something based on Twilight or based in someone else's fictional world. And it's perfectly legal even for copyrighted works as long as they're not trying to sell them. There's also this subcategory of real person fanfic, which features celebrities. And this particular book is about the boy band One Direction, and in particular, the singer Harry Styles. And I was very surprised to learn that this is a very popular category of fanfiction. There's hundreds of thousands of these works on the internet where people are just imagining that they're hanging out with a band. It gets a little racier than that, as you can imagine. And this particular story called After caught the attention of publishers because it got millions and millions of readers online. By the time Simon & Schuster had signed it up, 800 million people had looked at it.
Wow.
Yes.
So tell us about this deal.
So the deal was a six-figure four-book deal, and it also was optioned for film rights by Paramount Pictures. And it's really unusual because Simon & Schuster, the imprint is Gallery Books, they're leaving this fan fiction story up for free online. Meanwhile, they've put out the first volume of the book this week for $16. So it's a real experiment to see if they can reach a whole new audience in print, which is their goal, while this thing remains online for free. Now this story has gotten a billion views, which is, you know, astonishing. And the publisher said, you know, you can't pay for this kind of advertising. So many people are looking at this story. Maybe they'll read a little bit and think, you know, I'll buy the paperback.
Yes, people have a lot to say and write about One Direction.
Oh, they sure do. And, you know, Gallery Books has been sort of the leader in this. They've already put out six books that started out as fan fiction. Not all of them have been hits, but one sold pretty well. It's called Beautiful Bastard, and it's also Twilight fan fiction, also erotica, so sort of in the 50 Shades mold. And that has a million copies in print now, and the authors are putting out more books, and they're going into YA. So it's really become an area that publishers are looking to, not just to find new talent, which is certainly what they're looking for. They're looking for the high hit counts. But they're also really trying to recapture some of these young readers who have migrated online and are reading stuff that's free. They're reading a lot of it on their cell phones, and publishers are nervous about losing them.
All right. So we've had novels arising from blogs, novels arising from fan fiction, novels, I believe, coming out of Twitter.
It's definitely
like going to a secluded writer's colony and quietly writing your book by candlelight is just going to be, you know, a radical act now.
Exactly. That's a really interesting point. And this, you know, novelist, this is her first work. She's 25 years old. Her name is Anna Todd. She told me the only way she knows how to write is socially. So she'll post a chapter, get immediate feedback. She spends 5 hours a day writing, 3 hours a day on Twitter, trading messages with fans. She said she couldn't imagine writing a whole novel by herself and then sending it out to a publisher. She's just not programmed to create that way.
All right. It's a whole new world. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thank you.
Lucy Worsley joins me now from London to talk about her new book, The Art of the English Murder. Hi, Lucy.
Hello there.
So we've got Halloween coming up here. This is a very appropriate topic, but you've done a whole BBC series on this subject.
I have. I must admit, and I'm, you know, not entirely comfortable in saying this, that I enjoy a good murder. And I sort of suspect that you do too. You know, it is possible for us as human beings to take pleasure out of bad things happening to other people. And that's part of the thrill of Halloween, isn't it? And because I'm a historian, I was really interested to discover where that came from, what it's all about. How can we do this thing that sounds on the face of it immoral and wrong?
Well, your title is The Art of the English Murder. Are the Brits especially fascinated with killing?
Well, I would argue that they are, because this phenomenon of enjoying the experience of reading about a murder, I'm talking here about fiction or also non-fiction journalism and that sort of thing, it's something that really pops up in English culture about the 1800s, so at the start of the 19th century. And it seems to me that it's something that happened at the same time as Britain was industrializing. And people were moving away from the villages, where perhaps their greatest fears were dying of disease or in a war. And they're moving to the towns, where life was cleaner and safer and more comfortable. And that allowed sort of new fears to become available to them, fears that are quite ludicrous, like worrying about being murdered by the strange man who lives next door. And because Britain industrialized early, I think that these fears became part of our culture earlier than they did in other countries. But obviously, other countries have caught up now, and every country has its own genre of detective fiction.
You start with Thomas De Quincey, who we associate, or at least I associate, with opium eating, not with murder.
Exactly. But he was one of the earliest people to notice this new correlation between reporting of crime and violent death, and people buying the new cheap newspapers and lapping it all up. And he wrote a seminal essay on murder as considered as one of the fine arts. And this is actually a satire. He imagined this club of connoisseurs of murder who would sit around talking about all the latest crimes and picking out which ones they felt were the best, the most artful, the most praiseworthy. But actually his point was, this is bad. We shouldn't be doing this. But he was onto something. The people in late Georgian England really had started to do this. They started to consume murder in a way that you can still see the modern media doing it today. Just look at the Pistorius trial, for example.
So this essay he wrote in 1827, but it stemmed from a set of murders that took place in 1811. What happened?
Well, in 1811, there was a particularly horrific crime down in the Dockland area of London, and it was called the Radcliffe Highway Murder, because that's the street where it took place. And there were four victims killed all in the same night. There was the father, the mother, their little baby boy, and the apprentice who lived with them. And nobody was ever actually caught for the crime. But the reason it made such an impact is that this was four people all at once, all in one night. And in the whole of the previous year of 1810, only 15
murderers had been convicted in the whole of Britain. So it was suddenly like the volume had been turned up. And these new sort of technological breakthroughs, the cheap newspapers, they realized that when there was a murder, like the Radcliffe Highway murder, they will get good sales.
So you talk about how these, you know, social changes, the movement from the countryside to the city led to this creation of new fears. But you also say that the British enjoyed and consumed the idea of murder, that it was really a form of a kind of entertainment. What's behind that?
Well, if people realize that they can get a thrill about out of reading about a murder in a newspaper, then it's very likely that they're going to look for the same sort of experience at the theater, for example. And that was behind this new genre of entertainment called the melodrama, the reenactment of murders on stages. Perhaps they would buy ballads about notable murderers. There's a lot of them in circulation. And if you didn't have the money to go to the theatre, well, then you could go and see it at the puppet theatre, for example, the travelling puppet theatre that went around the whole of England. So particularly grisly crimes, like the murder of a famous victim called Maria Martin, who was a young, innocent girl of the village, got killed in Suffolk. Her murder was performed on the puppet stage. And if you go to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London today, you can still see these wonderful marionettes they have showing this poor girl and her murderer. And you'd think, wow, this is a grisly form of entertainment. Who wants to go and see a girl being killed? But it has an awful lot in common, I'm sorry to say, with some of our violent computer games that we still have today. This is a part of popular culture that was going to endure.
If you go to the Tower of London or any other, you know, many other sites, you can see that obviously murder and public hangings and that sort of thing was a popular source of public entertainment well before the 19th century. But what you say changed was the scale. Give us a sense of what happened.
Well, I think that you can see it in the numbers of the newspapers sold, which run into the millions. And ballads circulating in very large numbers as well. And you see it starting to crop up in fiction as well, in Dickens, for example. And there's a strong strand of Dickens, Charles Dickens, who is a crime writer. Another thing that happens in society more broadly is that, you know, people are living in cities. They don't know their neighbours anymore. Old community-based notions of policing don't work anymore. So we get a professional paid police force being set up. And as you move into the later 19th century, detective fiction really becomes established with writers like Wilkie Collins. And as we go into the 20th century, then it is just everywhere. I believe in 1936, one in every three books sold was a crime novel. So something started around 1820 that was going to grow and grow.
Did the British really originate detective fiction?
Well, you can argue otherwise, but I think that it's a type of writing that particularly took hold in Britain very early on. Obviously, today, if you look at Scandinavia, that's a very dangerous place. I would be frightened to go to Scandinavia because I've read so many murder stories set in Scandinavia.
Yes.
But each country, as it industrializes, as it develops, I think, you know, as it enters modern life, gets all the things that go with modern life, all the things we enjoy about modern life, and I'm joking here, they include neuroses and paranoia and fear of life in the city.
It seems like the many people's minds, the sort of murder was Jack the Ripper. You can still go on Jack the Ripper tours in London.
Yes.
Why?
Why? Well, there's something nasty about this. The idea that you want to go and see the places where these six women lost their lives on the streets of East London. There's something glamorous and terrifying about the concept that this was a single serial killer. I think with Jack the Ripper, there's the attraction of the mystery as well, because over the time since the Summer of Fear in the 1880s, no less than 150 different suspects have been proposed as the real Jack the Ripper. People are always saying they've worked out who it is. Well, no, the field is wide open, so anybody can sort of come forward with an intriguing new theory. But the other attraction, I think, of murderous entertainment is the sense that you can get of closure, of justice being done. I mean, that's the positive side of detective fiction very often, that something bad happens, but the detective comes in and sorts it all out. justice is restored, and that makes you feel better about yourself and your possibly interesting relationship with the man next door who you don't know anything about and who does creepy things.
Is there anything creepy about the British fascination with murder?
I think that I feel myself a little bit, you know, embarrassed about my consumption, my avid consumption of all of these books throughout history that are about, that at the heart of them have somebody's death. That's the catalyst. That's the heart of the action. It's death. But, you know, I would say to anybody who criticized me for that, have you ever been in your house on a really rainy day and you've looked out of the window at the rain and you've seen some poor person going past and they've looked wet and cold, and surely you have thought, I'm glad that's not me. I'm happy to be safe inside my cozy house. And my pleasure in that is heightened by the fact that other people are out in the rain. And I think that it's just an extension of that feeling that allows us to read, you know, the trial of Oscar Pistorius and to be incredibly drawn into it and fascinated by it and be really glad that we're not there.
All right. Well, we will end on that nice note for Halloween's sake. Lucy, thank you so much for joining us.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And I'm sorry about the crackly line and my gesticulations.
No, that's okay. The book again is The Art of the English Murder by Lucy Worsley. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
On the hardcover fiction list this week, there are a bundle of new titles, starting with poetry. Down at number 15, Mary Oliver, who has a Pulitzer to her name and a previous bestseller with a collection of dog poems, has a...
What could compete with that?
Well, her new one is called Blue Horses, not a collection of horse poems, despite the title, but her usual kind of nature lyric poetry, and it is her second bestseller, new at number 15. Then at number 12, Debbie McComber has a book called Mr. Miracle, new on the list. At number 11, Ellen Hildebrand, famous as a Nantucket kind of summer writer, has her first winter book. It is still set on Nantucket. It's called Winter Street, and it is about Nantucket at Christmas time. Then at number 10, Richard Flanagan, who won this year's Booker Prize in England, an Australian novelist, has his first bestseller with that Booker winner, The Narrow Road to the Deep North.
The prize bounce.
The prize bounce. There you go. Actually, the Booker has done very well on the bestseller list over the last decade. This is the 9th consecutive Booker winner to make our list. And then finally, at number 1, all the way at the top of the list, Jodi Picoult's new one. She's become accustomed to entering the list at number 1. Her new one is called Leaving Time. It enters the list at number 1. Earlier in her career, she used to try to knock off her rivals more surreptitiously. She would go into bookstores and move her books on top of the James Patterson stacks at bookstores. But this week, James Patterson is down at number 4, so she didn't need to do that.
She just pushed John Sanford to the side.
That's right.
All right, nonfiction?
Nonfiction, there are only 3 new titles. They are all written by actors. Down at number 15, Alan Cumming, famous on Broadway from Cabaret Revival maybe 15 years ago.
And other people might know him from superhero movies, right?
Yeah. And also Circle of Friends was his first big breakthrough here. He's a Scottish actor, but his first American Hollywood breakthrough was Circle of Friends back in like 1995, I think. He has a really interesting memoir out called Not My Father's Son. It's not your usual kind of daddy dearest memoir, as the San Francisco Chronicle put it in their review. It tells the story of how he appeared on a celebrity genealogy show in Great Britain a few years back, hoping to find out more information about his maternal grandfather, who had died before he was born. And what he found out instead really surprised him. And that's all I'll say here.
Wow, you're going to force people to read the book. Okay.
Then at number 6, Neil Patrick Harris has a book, a memoir called Choose Your Own Autobiography.
Working in one of my favorite genres.
Yes, it is, in fact, choose your own book. In footnotes, he kind of directs you to jump to other sections if you want to read about his interest in magic, if you want to read about his hosting the Emmys and the Tonys. So you can read it straight through, or you can kind of follow the footnotes and jump around in it.
But we can't change the course of his life.
We cannot.
All right.
And then at number three, finally, Cary Elwes, who was the star of The Princess Bride, has written a book about The Princess Bride with a writer named Joe Layden called As You Wish, and it kind of takes readers behind the scenes of that cult hit.
Anybody want a peanut? All right. Thanks,
Greg. Inconceivable.
Thank you.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.